Hello, members all, and welcome to Shedcast number 7, a visitor's view of medieval England. Now then, for 30 years, ladies and gentlemen, members, I have been plagued, I tell you, by a question which came up when I was studying A-level history. As I remember, I'd been persuaded to study for the Oxbridge exams, which was a silly suggestion in almost all respects, and would not end well, I have to tell you. But nonetheless, it gave me a few more months playing darts in the local. There is no cloud without its silvery lining, as they say. Anyway, in the history classes, the topic of nationalism came up. During this debate, I have to tell you slightly boastfully that I read Immanuel Kant, who I'm told was a real pissant and very rarely stable, just as Aristotle was a bugger for the bottle. To this day, I have never done anything more intellectual than read Immanuel Kant, and I beam with pride. Didn't understand a word of it. Well, I mean, I understood most of the individual words. It's just the way the guy put them together into sentences that threw me. But hey, how impressive is that? Anyway, the point of this ramble is that I was emphatically told, emphatically, categorically, and without let or indeed hindrance, that there was no nationalism before the modern age. That's it. That medieval man didn't give a tinker's curse about a nation of England. They had too many other allegiances to worry about. There was no one shared consciousness, no effective mean of communication. They were all part of one Christendom anyway. Huh, I thought. Fancy. Anyway, given that I saw references to the word English and England from the time pretty much of Alfred and certainly after the Conquest, and William of Malmesbury lamenting and crying into his mead the lot of the English at the hands of the Norman oppressors, I found this really difficult to understand. So, the whole nationalism thing has always irritated me. How could you possibly say that medieval English were not a nation? Does my head in. So that long, long preamble is all there to introduce three episodes, the first of which is this one. Really, today's episode is no more than a gentle aperitif, an anteroom to the main meal. A look at four impressions of England by foreign visitors between 1497 and 1554. These are documents which reside in the wonderful compilation called English Historical Documents, on which I rely so much. So, it's a bit of fun. What did foreigners think of us, as far as we can tell? Then the main meal, the next episode, which I've split into two because it's something of a whopper, is my attempt to resolve the personal problems I relate above. Not the one about why I could never hit double tops in the Griffin Inn, but the one about English national consciousness in the late Middle Ages. Something to look forward to then. There are four documents then, the first in 1497 from an unknown Italian visitor, the second from a Venetian called Andrea Trevisano in 1500, and then John Mayer, a Scot, in 1521, and finally the Spanish in 1554. Let us see what common threads we can find and see if we can fulfil Rabi's desire for some power to see ourselves as others see us. Which is not, incidentally, something I've ever longed for. Seriously not. Oh, can you imagine? A note before we launch onto the Italian impressions. Those of you who have listened to Shedcast 1, The Practice of Diplomacy, will know that the Italian city-states perfected very early the diplomatic process. And as part of their professionalisation of the activity, they insisted that their ambassadors or visitors send back reports, called relazioni. It is this which gives us three of these foreign impressions. It's worth noting a few things about these. First of all, these are enthusiastic amateurs who don't have the language to really understand what's going on, but then there's no drawback in that if our intention is to see how others saw us. Secondly, these are sadly limited accounts geographically. Essentially, they pretty much exclusively travel to London with a bit of Dover, Canterbury and Oxford thrown in. Incredibly, none of them bothered to go to Loughborough, which just seems, well, amazing. This is a gag no one outside England will understand, of course. Just trust me, Loughborough would be a long way down anybody's list anyway. The point is, we can't treat these reports as an authoritative study of England and the English. These are views that are entirely biased towards the particular experience each of them had. In one case, they had a seriously disappointing trip. But this was the Spaniards visiting in 1554 when the Protestant Reformation had happened. Queen Mary was marrying Catholic Philip of Spain, so unsurprisingly, there was little love lost. Generally then, one thing they all agree on is that England is a rich and fertile place, flowing with both milk and with honey. And actually, the thing that gets mentioned as much as the wool, and of course you'd expect wool to get mentioned, is tin. all the visitors note the industry, and it's clearly something outstanding. Partly the reason for this seems to be the pride the English took in burnished pewter jewellery and cups, which a couple of people mention. Quote, "They eat off that fine tin, which is little inferior to silver." Quite a lot inferior to silver, I'd have said. I've never understood the pewter thing. The other reason is that in the Middle Ages, tin seems to have been pretty much non-existent anywhere else. So little old Devon and Cornwall in the far southwest seem to have served all of Western Europe. Tin would be carried down to the southwest of France and sold there, and then wine carried back. The exclusivity of tin in England and the length of the mining tradition meant that a specialist life grew up around it. The districts that produced tin became known as the stannaries, from the Latin for tin, which of course you'll know is stannum. Specialist courts grew up around the region to administer special rights for miners, and the regions produced valuable income for the English crown. Tin had been mined in Devon and Cornwall since the Bronze Age all the way up to our period. It was focused around tin streams. But through the 14th century, tin began to be worked out in this way. Production in Devon almost disappeared, so Cornwall predominated. We're talking quantities of about 250 to 650 tonnes a year, by the way. So in the early 16th century, the exhaustion of tin streams meant that industrial mining techniques had to be developed and used. Open cast mining began to be used with the arrival of gunpowder, but also deep mining began to appear. Now I'm told that unlike coal, which is found in a flat, wide bed, tin has bubbled up from the depths in molten magma, and therefore needs to be mined in deep vertical shafts, which immediately gave massive problems of removing water, which led to big buildings to house the water pumps. And these it is that in some places still survive in the Cornish countryside, by and large the result of a later boom in the 19th century. Anyway, enough of tin. I was talking about a rich and fertile land. Oddly enough, the climate gets a reasonable write-up, which is rather gobsmacking, since I'd have thought it'd get a hammering from the Mediterranean crew, though the Scot could hardly complain. John Mayer was too busy writing about oats anyway, which was rather delightfully true to the Scottish idiom. Anyway, it soon becomes apparent why the Venetians missed the problem with the English weather. Here we go. The rain falls every day during the months of June, July and August. They never have any spring here, according to the reports of the islanders. Now I could write an essay on this small quote. First of all, this was a special mission of a limited period, so I'm left with the impression that Andrea, the author, thought that maybe June to August was the rainy season. Wrong, Andrea. What you were seeing was our good stuff, the dry stuff. The rest of the year is even worse. Secondly, let me note the whining of English gardeners and farmers, which rises in a gentle mist wherever you go in England, as anyone who has ever listened on the radio to Farming Today or Gardener's Question Time will know. Of course, we have spring in England. But of course, as far as gardeners and farmers are concerned, it's always been the worst spring ever and completely weird, isn't it terrible, and so on. I can see the islanders bending poor old Andrea's ear about their parsnips as we speak. There's a lot of complimenting of the richness of England's lands, fields, rivers, forests and all that. There's even talk about fish. Not sure if there are any fishermen out there. Given that I've only ever caught gudgeon out of the River Soar, I can't really claim any expertise, but apparently perch, tench, carp are not indigenous to England. Huh. I confirm that's true in the case of carp. Can't speak for the others. Sadly, amongst all this plenty, the farmers get a clattering. First of all, the Italian visitors note in surprise that for such a fertile place, there don't seem to be many Englishmen around. It's all very underpopulated. Which is fair enough, especially if you've just come from Milan or Venice. They explain it all with a pretty damning attack on English farmers. The farmers are so lazy and slow that they do not bother to sow more wheat than is necessary for their own consumption. They prefer to let the ground be transformed into pasture for the use of the sheep that they breed in large numbers. Or as Andrea put it even more damningly, if less outwardly rudely, agriculture is not practiced in this land beyond what is needed for the consumption of the people. Now it's interesting. In a sense, of course, they are right to point out that England's agricultural economy is very much oriented around subsistence, as indeed was most of Europe. It meant that Europe's economy, which was very inefficient, supported far fewer people and was far less sophisticated than, for example, China. And the gap was even more stark when compared with the areas of Europe which had a greater density of population, such as northern Italy and Flanders, where the potential for farmers to grow cash crops to service the towns was that much greater. It's also interesting that medieval man essentially had no economic theory to help interpret the world around them, so rather than understanding the impact of the Black Death, and a low population, a low urban density on England's economy, reasons had to be looked for in personalities and national characteristics. So rather than the absence of sufficient labour to support crop production, and therefore a switch to pasture, it's lazy farmers at fault. There really is a general theme here. So many issues are personalised rather than conceptualised. And so to London, which to all the visitors again is something of a marvel. If only they could have seen the Birmingham Bullring in the 1970s, but in the absence of that, it's London and universal wonder. For John Mayer, that's entirely understandable, given that even Edinburgh was probably something like 8,000 people strong compared to London's 50,000. For the Italian visitors, used to the sights of Venice, Milan and Florence, which were far larger than London, it is praise indeed. In a single street, named Cheapside, leading to St. Paul's, there are 52 goldsmith shops, so rich, so full of silver vessels, great and small, that all the shops of Milan, Rome, Venice and Florence put together. Both John Mayer and the Italian visitors are blown away by London Bridge. Here's John. "The city is adorned with a right noble bridge, on which are houses richly built, and likewise a church." Can I say how proud I am not to have used a fake Scottish accent there? The temptation almost made my head explode. All of them seem fascinated by the concept of a tidal river, but all remark on the watercraft plying their trade up and down. And when the streets were dirty and close and dangerous, the river was a comparatively easy way of getting round, with all kinds of waterboatmen plying their trade. Despite the appalling sewerage situation, swans seem to survive and indeed thrive. John Mayer again. "There are to be found on the Thames 3,000 or 4,000 tame swans." Now this is turning into something of a did you know cast, but you might be interested to know that swan was a great luxury food-wise, and therefore the Crown had nabbed the rights to any unmarked swan on open water, including the Thames. However, it did grant the rights out to various folks, and therefore you get a tradition called swan upping, where the owner of the local rights would take up the swans on their stretch of the river and mark them with nicks on the beak. There are still swan upping ceremonies at multiple places along the Thames these days, normally involving blazers. Anyway, this is not to be a podcast on London, so let me therefore just note that London gets a good press. Tick. With one exception. "All the streets are so badly paved that they get wet at the slightest quantity of water, and this happens very frequently on account of the rain, of which there is a great deal in this island. Then a vast and evil-smelling mud is formed, which lasts nearly the whole year round." Which leads our Italian friend to note the use of rushes on the floors of houses, and that this is a problem throughout England, which is, of course, absolutely right. What about the locals then, which is really what we want to hear about, isn't it? How did they strike our visitors? Italy first. The English are, both men and women of all ages, handsome and well-proportioned. So far so good. Here's another one. "I have understood from persons acquainted with those countries that the Scotch are much handsomer." Oh, come on. Clearly, from persons unacquainted with spectacles to boot. The Spaniard, however, was less impressed, specifically, I'm afraid, with English women. You have to remember that this chap is really, really cross. It's been a rotten visit. He's cross with everything to do with England. "All the women here wear petticoats of coloured cloth without any admixture of silk, and above comes coloured robes of damask satin or velvet, very badly cut. Their shoes are sometimes of velvet, but more often of leather, and they wear black stockings and show their legs up to the knee when walking. As their skirts are not long, they are passably immodest when walking and even when seated. They are neither beautiful nor graceful when dancing, and their dances only consist in strutting or trotting about. Not a single Spanish gentleman has fallen in love with one of them, nor takes any interest in them, and their feeling for us are the same." Interesting translation, passably immodest. Does the original mean mildly immodest, I wonder, or more like satisfyingly immodest, but it'd be great if they're a little more immodest? Later on, just to make sure we haven't missed the point, he adds that the ladies of the Spanish delegation, quote, have not joined the court because they would have no one to talk with, as the English ladies are of evil conversation. The English ladies clearly put our friend out in other ways as well. For who in any other land ever saw a woman riding forth as they do here, where many of them manage their horses with consummate skill and are as firm in the saddle as any man? Our Italian visitors were a little more complimentary about English dress sense. They dress in the French fashion, except that their suits are more full, more out of shape. Okay, it's not a lot more complimentary, but I have myself always carefully cultivated the fuller, out of shape style. So it's gratifying to know that I'm following the example of medieval man too. The later visitors remark, they all from time immemorial wear very fine clothes, are extremely polite in their language. In addition to their civil speeches, they have the incredible courtesy of remaining with their heads uncovered with an admirable grace when they talk to each other. They are gifted with good understandings and are very quick at everything they apply their minds to, which is handsome, thank you. But sadly, as good as it gets, for there are clearly a few things which have struck many of the visitors. I may as well start with the children thing, which perplexed the Italians enormously. The want of affection in the English is strongly manifested towards their children, for everyone, however rich he may be, sends his children away into the houses of others. I, for my part, believe they do it because they like to enjoy their comforts themselves, and they are better served by strangers than their own children. The earlier Italian group agreed, writing with horror at the practice that a man would leave all his property to his wife. Quote, at death, a man must leave all his property to his wife completely, excluding the children, for whom they show no affection, lavishing all their love on their wives. And consequently, because wives have the same dislike for their children, they choose in the end a husband from among the servants and ignore the children. Then there's a beautifully bleak comment to follow. There are also other habits in this style, very different from our own customs, but from what I have said, it can easily be guessed what they are. Well, I can't, but so if you've got any theories, answers on a postcard, please. The lack of affection thing, though, is a bit of a theme. Back to Andrea in 1500. Although their dispositions are somewhat licentious, I have never noticed in anyone, either at court or among the lower orders, to be in love. Whence one must necessarily conclude either that the English are the most discreet lovers in the world, or that they are incapable of love. I say this of the men, for I understand it is quite contrary with the women, who are very violent in their passions. I have nothing to add on this point. Which brings us to a few areas where all the visitors furiously agree. As to what the English really like doing, it is absolutely clear. They show no signs of schooling, but they delight in banquets and variety of meat and food, and they excel everyone in preparing them with excessive abundance. They eat very frequently, at times more than is suitable, and are particularly fond of young swans, rabbits, deer, and seabird. As far as I can see, if it moved, the English would eat it. Although nobody's yet invented reconstituted meat slurry, so there's a way to go. John Mayer noted, nor do they dislike what we so abominate, i.e. crows, rooks, and jackdaws. When they're not eating, the English were drinking. In fact, whether they're eating or not, they were drinking. This is a thread you can follow from any time you like. Anglo-Saxon England all the way through to a Saturday night in 21st century Carlisle, there's a good chance the Englishman or woman would be drunk. John Mayer was the gentlest in his words. The common people make two beverages from wheat, barley and oats, one of which is called beer, the other ale. And these liquors are much liked by them, nor are they disliked by foreigners after they have drunk them four or six times. They are most agreeable to the palate when a person is by some change heated. Our Spaniard was less gentle. There is plenty of beer here, and they drink more than would fill the Valladolid River. The ladies and some gentlemen put sugar in their wine, with the result that there are great goings on here in the palace. Moving away from great goings on in the palace, which sounds interesting, we come to the thing they all agree on and all mention. Even the soft-spoken and generally complimentary John Mayer is forced to note that the inhabitants of all Britain are of a proud temper and given to fighting. And although at this stage he's tarring the rest of Britain with the same brush, it gets personal.
in courage, in prudence, in all virtues of this nature, Englishmen do not think themselves the lowest of mankind. And if, in a foreign land, they happen upon a man of parts and spirit, 'tis pity, they say, he's not an Englishman. So essentially, violent and a bit pleased with themselves. It gets worse as we move to the Spaniard. There are an incredible number of robbers here. They go about in bands of 20, and neither justice nor God avail to hold them back. And even the Italians note a certain level of enthusiasm for the martial arts. All exercise themselves in a marvellous way with great bows of yew wood, with which they practice continually outside the walls. They also fight with them on foot in such a way as to show they have been enthusiastically trained in this from their earliest youth. Sadly, all this pride and enthusiasm for violence seems to have been vented on foreigners. Let us start with the Italians. Londoners have such fierce tempers and wicked dispositions that they not only despise the way in which Italians live, but actually pursue them with uncontrolled hatred. And whereas at Bruges, foreigners were hospitably received and complimented and treated with consideration by everyone, here the Englishmen use them with the utmost contempt and arrogance, and make them the object of insults. At night, they sometimes drive us off with kicks and blows of the truncheon. And again, they have an antipathy towards foreigners and imagine they have never come into their islands but to make themselves masters of it and to usurp their goods. So, suspicious as well as xenophobic. Here comes another one. The English hate us Spaniards worse than they hate the devil, said the Spanish contingent in 1554, and treat us accordingly, though they seem to have taken their lives in their hands, which they regretted. We went to London last Sunday, which we ought not to have done, seeing the way Spaniards are treated here. The kind of welcome that is good enough for them is to refuse to give them lodgings and insult them as if they were savages. Even in inns, they are ill-treated and robbed. Having said all that, the 1554 example is a little unfair. England was now a confirmed Protestant country after Edward VI's reforms. Mary had started burning leading heretics, and public opinion was deeply opposed to the Queen's marriage with the King of Spain. But to develop the theme, there's plenty of evidence that it was not just the Spaniards and Italians who felt the rough edge of the English tongue, or indeed, truncheon. Within these letters, there's also an indication of the attitude of the English towards their British partners. As regards Ireland, I could say a few things, such as their life is crude and coarse, and that the men's clothing is made from rough, greasy cloths, and other such-like things. Given that the Italian in question hadn't been to Ireland, this would reflect the standard attitude of the English towards the Irish, whom they regarded as barbaric and backwards, and the same applied to their attitude to the Welsh. The attitude towards the Scots was a little more nuanced, given more of a shared heritage amongst the nobility and Scotland's existence as a foreign state. The same hatred of foreigners, or non-English, was very evident in the previous centuries as well. So the case of the Jews had added religious angles, of course, but the Jews were expelled by Edward I in the 13th century. In the 14th and 15th century, one of the most populous groups in England were the Flemings. The Flemings as a community were highly visible within London, they spoke a different language, they were very numerous, and they dominated the stews of Southwark. In 1381, during the Peasants' Revolt, the London Chronicle recorded, "And many Flemings lost their heads at that time, and namely that they could not say bread and cheese, but only ca on bruda." It's very easy to assume from this that the English were an unusually xenophobic bunch, a most unattractive attribute, obviously. And actually, I'm not going to deny it, but I am going to mitigate it a bit. Only a bit, it has to be said. I'm tempted to say that it's unlikely that England was alone in its suspicion of foreigners in the 15th century, but I sadly have to admit that I don't have much ammunition to support it, though I can say that just as the English thought themselves to be the bee's elbows, so did the French. That feeling of racial exclusivity appears to be pretty reasonably common throughout Europe. What also transpires is that the Flemings were not unusual, and that the English were actually well used to having aliens among them. There was rarely trouble, actually. The Flemings were unusual in the density of their presence in London and their visibility. It's also true that in 1381, the peasants actually agreed on relatively few things in their revolt, and attacking the Flemings gave them a level of unity that it was hard for them to gain in other ways, which kind of rather encouraged it. From the work of someone called Sylvia Thrupp, and more recently the England's Immigrants Project, alien communities turn out to be much more widespread than might have been thought in the 15th century. We know quite a lot because of a tax introduced in 1440. The idea was that aliens should be identified and should pay a denization tax. Denization meant that the person concerned would renounce their previous allegiances and then be given the same rights as English-born subjects of the crown. What the project showed was that there could have been as many as 20,000 immigrants, or 1% of the total population. That immigrants were widely spread through England, while of course London had the greatest density, where immigrants may have amounted to 6% of the population. The largest source of immigrants were drawn from Scotland, Ireland, France and the Low Countries, and Northern Italy. They did a range of jobs as you'd expect. Merchants are the biggest single group, and the wealthy ones at that. But there were spinners from Ireland, Aragonese doctors, artists from the Low Countries, really quite a wide range. So, I claim some mitigation, but only some. Three of our four observers at least seemed very convinced that the English were violent, military, a people to be feared, proud, convinced of their own superiority, and paranoid about outsiders, and willing to show it. Which is interesting when it comes to think about the next topic, whether there was a sense of English national consciousness in the Middle Ages, since one of the key factors in that debate is whether or not the group called the English had a shared and described identity. So we're going to come to that next time in episodes 8A and 8B. So it just remains for me to thank you all for your very kind support. I really appreciate it. I put a little bit more information about the visitors I talked about today and a few extra quotes on the webpage for this episode if you want to go and have a look. Good luck, everyone, and have a great couple of weeks.